In our legal discussion today, we're looking at how consent can be used as a defence by someone accused of serious sexual offending against a child. In a recent case in Auckland, a man was found guilty of the rape of a 12-year-old he had claimed pursued him for sex. It's something victims advocacy groups believe need to be changed. Paulette Benton-Greig is a senior lecturer in law at AUT and has worked in areas of domestic and sexual violence. Welcome. Thanks very much, Paulette.
Morena, Catherine.
So can you explain, given the age of a child, what the law says at all about the possibility of consent and or specifically the defence of consent?
Okay, so when there's evidence of sexual connection with a child, sexual connection being the most invasive forms of sexual violence, so for instance, anal, genital or oral connection, there are some choices that prosecutors have when charging. So they can charge one offence, which is called sexual conduct with a child, which just requires them to prove that the sexual connection took place and there is no possibility of defence based on consent. And that offence has a maximum imprisonment of 14 years. Alongside of that, there is another offence known as sexual violation, what we traditionally think of as rape, which doesn't have an age-related element, so it can be charged no matter how old the complainant is. And that has the elements that the Crown or the prosecution has to prove, which is that the sexual connection took place, that the complainant didn't consent, and that defendant didn't believe in consent and didn't have reasonable grounds to believe in that. And that has a maximum sentence of 20 years. So when the evidence suggests that sexual connection took place, typically or often prosecutors will charge the sexual violation charge because it has a higher sentence and their legal duty is to charge at the level of seriousness of criminality. And so they take that signal from Parliament that the higher imprisonment rate signals it's more serious. So what we see often is that they will either charge just the sexual violation charge, in which consent is an issue, or charge them in the alternative. Either way, what typically happens at trial is that consent is an issue, and that means that both the prosecution and the defence counsel will ask the complainant about what they were thinking and feeling at the time to get to the issue of consent and what the circumstances of the sexual offending were in order to look at what the defendant might have thought or assumed to be the case. So it's quite common for that to be the case, and we're seeing it increasingly, I think, because the end sentences that are being given in cases where the sexual conduct charge that I talked about is charged are quite low, and so prosecution are feeling, you know, a responsibility to charge the more serious offence.
Can we talk about what the law says about consent? Most people think of the age of consent as 16, but that is it is absolutely not that clear-cut. And, of course, circumstances are different. You could have two 15-year-olds in a consensual sexual relationship, and what does the law say about that? But then what does it say about the age at which you are deemed to be in no position to give consent?
Well, the criminal law is made up of a range of prohibitions that are based on offences. So it doesn't have a declarative statement about the age of consent. So we have to look to what is prohibited. The sexual conduct charge that I just talked about applies to children under the age of 12. So for 11-year-olds and down, there is a charge where no consent can be argued. But as I've said, charging practices mean that that's not often what happens. There's also a charge that applies to young people, a sexual conduct charge for young people applying to 12 to 15-year-olds. And in that section, the Crown have to demonstrate that the sexual connection took place and the defence have an entitlement to raise a defence, both that they thought that the child or the young person was over the age of 16 and had reasonable grounds for that, and also that there was consent and they reasonably believed in that consent. So it's not as straightforward as saying that the age of consent is 16. The most we might say in that line is that the age of consent is actually 12, and that in many cases what happens at trial is that consent is the issue.
How does the law come at this then? If you have two people of similar age and development, is that different from having a clearly young child and a large age difference involved in an alleged offence? How does the law sort all this out, Paulette?
Well, it does come down to investigation and charging practices. So, for instance, you know, if you've got two young people in a consensual sexual relationship, presumably they're not making complaints to the police on the first hand. And if they do, then we need to investigate to see what the basis of that complaint is. If, you know, there's evidence of exploitation or there's evidence of harm being caused, then the prosecution have the ability to make a charge under that sexual conduct with a young person offence. But having said that, you know, a few years ago I did some research with teen parents, young parents, and one of the things I noticed when researching the circumstances around teen parents was that many of them might have been teenage parents themselves, but the fathers of those children were well into their 30s and 40s. So that circumstance in which young people are too consensual or young people having a consensual sexual relationship is not really where the law is and is not often what's happening in terms of young people.
What is happening in our courtrooms? Are we seeing quite young children being quizzed about whether they consented to things that most of us would consider they should know nothing about?
Yes. The Chief Victims Advisor Office put out a report, I think it was last year, called It's a Lie, and it documented the kinds of questioning that's taking place for children who are giving evidence as witnesses in child sexual abuse cases.
How young in some cases, Paulette?
Well, most of the complainants in that study were 12 to 14, I think, but there were some younger ones. And one of the most, I think, egregious examples that there is in that report is a six-year-old who was questioned by a defence counsel about why she kept returning to her grandfather's house after he had sexually violated her and proposed to her that she did so because she liked it. That's the kind of questioning that I think many New Zealanders would feel really uncomfortable about. And, you know, six-year-olds don't have volition over their movements, generally. And it's the kind of thing that we see regularly in the adult jurisdiction and often are outraged in the adult jurisdiction. So I think it's really important to understand that the same kinds of practices that we see in rape cases are happening in child sexual abuse and child rape cases.
Is it the case that either the law or, as you say, case law is completely out of touch with what has been learned and understood about the manipulations and the confusions of children who are being sexually offended against? Is there a large gap between what we have learned and what is being applied in our courts?
There's certainly some established bodies of research that would suggest that what we're doing is not good practice. Like, as well as this issue around consent, there's also plenty of research that suggests that the kinds of questioning that take place in the courtroom for children is often very confusing and age inappropriate. So multi-part questions, double negatives, complex ideas.
Wasn't that supposed to have been addressed in law reform, including providing protections like having children unable to see their accuser? Were there not improvements made?
There were some improvements made in legislation last year. That, for instance, allows children to have their cross-examination or their to give their evidence before trial, so closer in time to the actual event rather than waiting for trials, which are taking a long time at the moment. And that, we hope, will help with memory and also help them to be able to move on with their lives. But it doesn't change the nature of questioning, and that hasn't really been addressed. The nature of the kinds of questioning that we do in cross-examination really reflects a legacy in which we understand cross-examination to be effective at undermining or bringing into question the credibility and reliability of complainant evidence. But increasingly, I think we can see that it's actually having a lot of problematic effects. I've already talked about complexity, but there's also issues around the effect of questioning on memory for children and how it actually decreases the quality of evidence before the court. So I think that alongside of this issue of consent and how we deal with these charging practices and what the outcomes of those are, we also need to be rethinking the culture of cross-examination and the ways in that we think about how we test evidence in these cases.
I also recall the ideas of having experts present to assist judges mm-hmm. and perhaps juries in understanding how there might be inconsistencies in a child's evidence or things might be described a certain way. Again, have we not had these advances? And second to that, are these being held before judge or before jury? Because if it's the latter, then that's an even greater layer of complexity, isn't it?
Most trials will take place in front of a jury. The defendant can elect a judge alone trial, and that happens sometimes, but mostly they are before juries of 12 people.
Okay.
And mostly jurors, you know, people are not generally well informed about child sexual abuse. And it's difficult, isn't it,
just
to talk about?
Just very quickly, of course it is, and I appreciate you doing it because it is so important. Just very quickly, is there an appetite to look at change or the system? Is that actively considered at the moment?
I understand the Minister of Justice is interested and is taking advice on the issues, and that's a very welcome step forward because this is an area where governments are typically reactive rather than proactive because it's such a difficult area to engage with politically. So, yes, certainly they'll be wanting to hear, I think, from constituents if they have concerns.
Thank you very much for your time. Paulette Benton-Greig,